The indelible intro to Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana. The band evokes Seattle in the 90s, rain and flannel. They got their start on then tiny and now famous Seattle music label Sub Pop Records. The label began as a fanzine and has grown and evolved since the late 1980s.
Come on, boys!
From Mudhoney to the Murder City Devils to Heliosequence, Shabazz Palaces, and Father John Misty, Sub Pop has become the label for dozens and dozens of artists over the decades. Every man wears a symbol. We are at the world headquarters of Sub Pop Records. Megan Jasper, vice president of Sub Pop, is with me. And tell me again who your four-footed friend is.
Well, this is, to my left, is Mr. Vito Pepperoni. He has been one of the few beings that has worked in all of the Sub Pop offices, the terminal sales building, the joint in Belltown down the street, and this building as well.
So this is the third home of Sub Pop. Let's begin here in the lobby.
Okay.
What immediately caught my eye, of course, was this picture over here of this Sub Pop 20th anniversary Thank You Seattle on the top of the Space Needle, kind of looking down. What a great picture. And that was 2008?
It was. So that was July 2008, and Sub Pop was celebrating its 20th anniversary. And we did a few things around town before we had a big two-day festival at Marymore Park. But one of the great things that we did in Seattle was we were taken up to the top of the Space Needle because the top of it had been painted, and those folks were nice enough to put the Sub Pop flag on top of the needle. And I have to tell you that one of the best things I've ever seen in my entire life was seeing that thing waving on top of the needle. It was really a great moment.
What else is here in the lobby area that's noteworthy that you'd like to talk about?
So I would probably mention this original, I believe this is an invoice for the original pressing of Nirvana's Bleach record, and this was for the white vinyl copies, which are super collectible. It seems appropriate that above that invoice is a framed copy of numerous do not deposit insufficient funds checks that we made copies of, because those were also in abundance at the same time.
These were checks that Sub Pop bounced.
They bounced. Can you imagine how high the Sub Pop flag was on top of the Space Needle? Those checks bounced even higher than that.
a tough fiscal time. Well, I'm glad you can kind of just put them on the wall and laugh at them now.
Yeah, it's a good memory to have.
Yeah, a good memory to have. Yeah. You're not bouncing checks anymore.
God, no. I hope not.
After the tour through the offices and the warehouse of Sub Pop, Vice President Megan Jasper told me about the early days at the label.
It was the end of 1989. We were working with Nirvana and the Fluid and Mudhoney. Mudhoney was about to release their self-titled record, which did so well. And Nirvana were building up so much steam. And the Reverend Horton Heat was just about to sign to Sub Pop. And just so many exciting things.
It's one thing to be around musicians and around a creative scene. But what was happening in Seattle at that time became national, became international,
right.
Became gigantic. What was it like to kind of see that exploding all around you?
It was absolutely surreal because, you know, when something is building and you're in the midst of it, let alone at the epicenter of it, you don't have a perspective because you're in the middle of it. We just knew that people had given this thing a name and that it was affecting people's lives in some interesting ways, in some great ways, in some sad ways. And
what sad ways?
Well, a couple of things. One is Seattle was such an intimate, close, small community of people as far as the music scene went. And when there's a lot of attention that's being given to a neighborhood or a city or a scene, it opens it up and it allows for people to want to move there or to visit. And all of those things, they're both a blessing and a curse. You know, they can create more opportunities, but they also take away from that pure thing that felt really, really special. And whatever that thing is becomes diluted in the process. There are people who maybe would go out to shows regularly and all of a sudden didn't feel comfortable going to shows because they were in bands and they didn't want to be bothered or felt like they were something that they didn't feel like they were, a rock star. Or they just lost that feeling of knowing everyone who was at a show that their friend's band was playing.
So what they called grunge was blowing up, Nevermind was blowing up,
yeah.
And you're the receptionist at Sub Pop, and you get a phone call one day, and it's from the New York Times, and they wanted to talk to you about what this thing was. Tell us a little bit about that conversation.
I was lucky enough to get a job for Sub Pop's distribution company, Caroline Records, and I worked as the Northwest salesperson for Caroline, and I was in my apartment. I can't even tell you how many pots of coffee I had had that morning, a lot. And Jonathan called me and said, oh, you might get a call from the New York Times. They tried calling me, and I just felt like you were the better person to talk to. And so my phone rang, and I thought, oh, this will be fun. It will break up my day. And there was a reporter who was super, super nice, and he wanted to know what words people who loved grunge used. And, of course, you know, come on. It's not like there really was the secret language or lexicon, but I thought, well, I'll just have some fun and the conversation will end in a hearty laugh and we'll both go on and have our days. And but that laugh never came. I asked him to give me words and I would give him the grunge translation. I think he asked for articles of clothing. And so I said boots were kickers and sweaters were, I think I said fuzz, I can't remember. And then I thought, this is sounding too believable. I'll throw in some weird things to kind of throw it off. And that was Cobnobbler, which I think was a loser or something. I can't even remember, to be honest. And then that wasn't being questioned. And I was like, ugh. All right. So then I went super goofy and said, you know, how about swinging on the flippity flop? That's what we say for, you know, toodaloo. And that, you know, still no, like, come on.
It ended up in the paper, right, as the lexicon of grunge.
Yes, and I think you will appreciate that days later, I had totally forgotten about this, and then all of a sudden my mom called. My mom and I talk a lot on the phone, and she, in her perfect Worcester accent, said, holy sh! You're not going to believe this. You need to run down to 7-Eleven right now and pick up a New York Times. And so, like a good girl, I pulled my shit together and ran down to 7-Eleven and I picked up a New York Times and I could not believe what I saw. And I called my mom back and she was like, this is fabulous. And I thought, you know, it's a pretty good life when you can lie and get away with it and receive praise from your mom.
Now, of course, the New York Times is famous for their corrections. They correct every little error. Did they ever, like, do a correction and go, sorry, these were just kind of made up and we were being put on?
I don't think they ever did that. What happened was, I would say maybe a month or 2 months later, the Baffler had called me and they said, we know this is a joke. And I said, well, you know, of course it's a joke. I would say maybe a couple of weeks after that, I received a phone call from one of the editors at the New York Times, kind of coming down on me for lying, but then telling me that they printed it tongue-in-cheek. And I thought, well, then why are you upset with me? And then they asked where they could pick up shirts with the Lexicon of Grunge, and I thought, nah, there you go.
So you were here in 89, and you've talked a little bit about how the scene changed around people in good ways and in bad ways. When you think about, if you just kind of telescope the experience, 1989, mm-hmm. 2012, uh-huh. kind of think about, talk a little bit about the differences or maybe even the similarities at Sub Pop over that long stretch.
I think that some things that are very similar that still exist in Seattle music today is actually that sense of intimacy. This is a city, but it's a small enough community where actually we all know each other very, very well. And a lot of us can do interesting things because of that. So an example of that might be that Music for Marriage Equality campaign. That was a situation where, you know, a handful of people came together in the city.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because people might not realize Sub Pop's involvement in Referendum 74, the same-sex marriage measure, which has just passed. Uh-huh. And how did Sub Pop get involved in that? What was your involvement?
One of the things that we thought is, you know, what can we do as Sub Pop to help this? We can help get the word out just through our normal channels. We have a merchandising department, so we can help make T-shirts, we can help make pins, we can make stickers, whatever. And at one point, Carrie Harrop came to us and said, you know, this Matt Macklemore, a local artist, is about to release a new record. There's a song on it, and it really touches on all of these issues. What they would like to do as a band is to release this record for a short period of time until their full-length record comes out, and have the record, the song, as a single, released as a Sub Pop record, and they would love their earnings to go towards the support of marriage equality. And we thought, yes, absolutely, let's do it. We will also put our earnings in and double it.
And so, that song became kind of the anthem of Referendum 74.
It absolutely did.
When I was in the third grade, I thought that I was gay, because I could draw. My uncle was, and I kept my room straight. I told my mom, tears rushing down my face. She's like, Ben, you've loved girls.
Same Love by Seattle-based Macklemore, released on Sub Pop. You can hear my extended tour of Sub Pop with the label's vice president, Megan Jasper, at KUOW.org. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.
Have the characteristics, the right-wing conservatives think it's a decision, and you can be cured with some treatment and religion. Man-made rewiring of a predisposition, playing God. Ah, nah, here we go. America the brave still fears what we don't know. God loves all his children, it's somehow forgotten, but we paraphrase a book written 3,500 years ago. I don't know.
And I can't change.